This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Rami Almigari reports from the Gaza Strip as winter rains bring increased insecurity for the tens of thousands of Palestinians made homeless by Israel's 7 weeks of bombing. Also, Professor Stephen Salaita, fired from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for tweeting his outrage about Israel's attacks, delivers a speech in Chicago on his firing, the corporatization of the academy, and the notion of incivility.
The evidence in my case is clear. I'm no anti-Semite. I'm no terrorist. I'm no bully. I'm no savage. I'm a man who was fired because I condemned Israeli policy in language appropriate to a horrible occasion rather than in the meek platitudes of civility.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland. Thousands of people whose homes were bombed by Israel lack basic infrastructure, including electricity and access to water, and remain in metal caravan shelters or at United Nations-run schools in Gaza. Recently, heavy rainstorms swept through Gaza and further damaged the electricity, water, and sewage networks, which were already damaged or destroyed during Israel's 7-week attack on the Gaza Strip in July and August. Speaking to the Electronic Intifada on Wednesday was our Gaza correspondent Rami Almigari. He explained that even though international donors have promised reconstruction aid, rebuilding has not yet started. Further, the Electronic Intifada reported last week that half of the $5.4 billion pledged by international donors for reconstruction in Gaza will be diverted to fill holes in the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority's budget, while Palestinians seeking reconstruction aid will be forced to go through a 4-stage process administered by the United Nations. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima notes that the reconstruction plans underway in Gaza should be defined as, quote, disaster capitalism. Israel could likely become the main beneficiary as all approved vendors will order supplies through Israel via the Palestinian Authority. Abunima explains, quote, under the guise of reconstruction, the UN will be monitoring and gathering private information about Palestinian households to be passed on to Israel, which will have a veto over which families get aid to rebuild their homes. Gaza is to become ground zero for disaster capitalism, profiting from the suffering and incarceration of an entire population. I asked Rami Almigari to begin by talking about his latest article about families living in metal shacks and the ongoing restrictions on reconstruction materials.
My latest story was a sort of a portrait and a depiction of the situation on the ground, basically after the Israeli war on the territory, which devastated thousands of homes, houses, residences in the Gaza Strip, mainly on the border areas, eastern and southern areas of Gaza, and forcing tens of thousands of people homeless, without homes. Many thousands of them live now at UNRWA, run as schools and some places as a shelter. Others live with family members. Others live in rent houses, which have become so rare in the territory because of the immense and the widespread destruction. As far as the regarding the latest story about the people displaced in Khuza'a town, which has been devastated grossly during the Israeli war on Gaza. 450 families have been displaced. Only 100 have had the chance to be sheltered by a generous fund by the UA, the United Arab Emirates Charitable Works Society, in cooperation with the municipality of Khuza'a. As you saw in the story, these people live in a desperate life. They lack basic things for accommodation after they have lost their homes, absolutely. And they are now being sheltered in sort of boxes, metal boxes, or yes, these metal boxes that are like caravans, They are being the shelter at them. And I have heard recently, during the recent storm, unprecedented storm, early storm on Gaza, in which rains fell on the Gaza Strip, these people have had sort of a difficult time, as the electricity networks in the camp that I portrayed, I featured in the story, the electricity network was damaged because of the storm, and the network for water and for sewage water has been affected by the latest storm on the territory. And these people had no chance to be safe during the rains, which means that it's a very sort of alarming for the whole population of the Gaza Strip, particularly those who have been displaced, that the winter will be sort of a difficult time for these residents of the Gaza Strip, for these displaced residents, while the reconstruction process has not yet started. And that is really a sort of a bad happening here, because these people have been waiting since the war have ended in August of this summer, have been waiting for the reconstruction to take place. Recently, as you know, there was a sort of a conference for reconstruction of Gaza, international conference, in which the world countries, international countries, including the United States of America, European countries, have pledged recently a sort of a support estimated at $5.4 billion for the reconstruction of Gaza. But as up to this moment, nothing has happened on the ground, and the need is very desperate for the reconstruction to start immediately, because you talk about tens of thousands of families who have been displaced, and this suffering is reaching paramount, and unlike the previous wars on Gaza, the previous Israeli attacks on Gaza. And let me just explain to you that according to some official bodies, concerned bodies in the territory, only 440 tons of cement have entered yet the Gaza Strip. And this amount of cement, these quantities of cement will go mainly for those who had some sort of partial destruction into their homes or damage into their homes because of the last Israeli war on the coastal enclave, which means that this is a very little amount of cement, of raw building material, for materials for reconstruction to start in the war-battered Gaza Strip, in the war-torn Gaza Strip. This is really very basic and very limited. And as to the up to this moment, there have been sort of underway talks between all the parties concerned how to proceed with the reconstruction. Israel has been alarming or has been warning against the reconstruction, claiming or alleging that the amounts of raw building materials, or particularly the cement, will go to some Palestinian groups to be used in digging tunnels or something like that. The stereotypic Israeli story or Israeli allegations since the war has broken out and ended in the territory. But in the meantime, there we talk about a need of a civilian population that is suffering out of this lack of reconstruction that should be immediate as the concerned parties can. There has been a sort of agreement between Israel and UNRWA on the monitoring and observation of the entry of the cement and the stockpiling of the cement and the other raw building materials. And this observation monitoring system will started taking a place in Gaza, but nothing of this amount, of this quantity of cement has gone for the reconstruction, even for the partial reconstruction. This is the latest in about 1 day or 2 days ago, as far as I know, to the best of my knowledge as a reporter and working on a similar story that will be a sort of a follow-up to the last story. That is the situation, basically, in Gaza.
Rami, I know you're going to keep us posted on all the developments in the context of what's being done to make sure that people have adequate housing and infrastructure in Gaza. But talk about some of the stories that you're working on this week.
I am thinking about, actually, this is a good question. I'm thinking about featuring the agricultural life in Gaza, because Gaza is a coastal enclave that is based on agriculture, that is relying too much on agriculture, mainly on agricultural crops. And the main crop here in Gaza is the olives, which is a sort of a blessed tree for the Palestinians, a symbolic tree for the Palestinians in Gaza, in West Bank, in Jerusalem, and every part of Palestine, every part of Palestine. And this blessed tree is having a sort of a season, harvest season. And you can just see sort of extraction of the olives, picking up the olive, picking the olive tree. And this is a main crop in the territory. So that's what I'm going to focus on. It compared with the destruction of the lands, of the farmlands, during the last war, that has affected the agricultural sector, which is a main sector for a main source for living for many farmers here, or for many people here in the Gaza Strip. And I had heard, actually, which is a sort of amazing to hear that this season is said to be a good season for harvest of the olives, despite the wantonly Israeli destruction of the coastal territory, the widespread destruction on the border areas. There are farms. Also, I would like to feature something else other than the story of the olives. I would like to feature something about how the people are rejoicing with their lives as human beings, a normal life, to try to hang out, to release some of the high amount of pressure that have been enduring since the war has broken out and ended for the past 4 or 5 months.
Well, thank you, Rami, and we look forward to those stories.
Thank you very much, Nora. You're welcome.
That was Palestinian musician Mira Azar with her new song, Tell Me, Are You Okay With Yourself?, which aims to challenge Israel's attempts to recruit Palestinian citizens of the state to its occupation army. The track was recently released by Ehna TV, an independent Palestinian media group inside present-day Israel. Finally, we go to Chicago, where Professor Stephen Salaita recently spoke in a series of events related to his recent firing by the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign from a tenured position in the American Indian Studies program after pressure from pro-Israel donors and others enraged by Salaita's tweets condemning Israel's attacks on Gaza. The following is an excerpt of a speech Salaita gave at Northwestern University on October 6th. The next evening, Salaita delivered the speech at an event with the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima and grassroots resistance leader Bassem Tamimi at the University of Chicago. You can hear the entire speech on our SoundCloud page or at electronicintifada.net.
I want to thank everybody for coming out and for the SJP and other folks and Andy Thayer and others who worked so hard to organize this event. It's It's a great honor to be here. I'm going to speak broadly about my situation with the University of Illinois, and I hope to put it sort of in a broader context of academic freedom and related matters. And there's a lot to unpack in my termination from the University of Illinois. The first thing we must realize is that my situation is not exceptional. We are all affected by it. In the boardrooms and classrooms, as well as in the STEM fields, arts, humanities, social sciences, physical plants, and student affairs. Those effects bode well for few other than the corporate elite and the well-heeled commentariat. Before I say anything about Palestine and the University of Illinois, let me first acknowledge that what happened to me has been happening to ethnic, sexual, and cultural minorities in academia for decades, African Americans especially, and it continues to happen today. A shameful irony is that Jews were long marginalized in the academy because of their supposed dangers to Anglo-civility, victim to rationalizations for their exclusion that sadly don't look terribly different than the ones now being used against supporters of Palestinian human rights. So I want to honor those before and alongside me, and those in the future on whose behalf we struggle for a better world. A friend and one of my intellectual heroes said of academic freedom, "It was never for us anyway." Any cursory review of the history of American universities proves this observation true. The suppression of blackness and indigeneity predates the purge of Palestine and in many ways contextualizes and sustains it. The regulation of deviant bodies, ideas, and identities has influenced American campuses since their inception. With some exceptions, the ethos of the university as a site of special intellectual dispensation came into existence based on exclusion. My situation makes no sense outside of this context. Nothing in academia makes sense at the level of individuality. We are in it together, whether or not we want to be. Why then has my case received such attention? It's not an easy question to answer, because much of it has to do with unquantifiable factors like timing and the mood of the zeitgeist. Some answers do exist, however, which I believe illuminate important things about the state of speech in universities today. First, the university's decision was egregious. Even folks generally uninterested in academic freedom took note of the administration's high-handed discourse and underhanded behavior. Its decision appears to be punitive, leaving me and my family in a difficult situation, without income, a home, or health insurance. It also comes on the heels of Israel's devastation of Gaza, which resulted in the death of over 500 children. People were already tuned into Palestine. Other reasons. The University of Illinois is a good school with a distinguished history. It's supposed to be above such Bush League actions, though its history says otherwise. The presence of institutional racism on campus, from the not really retired Chief Illini Weck to declining black enrollment, has caused much frustration to become more explicit. In short, people working in academia are fed up with administrative intimidation, with implicit and explicit racism, with trustee interference, with eroded academic freedom, with lack of shared governance, with neoliberal structures. My firing includes all of these concerns. It is a flashpoint for administrative misconduct and faculty grievance. I don't think we should overlook the sheer arrogance with which the Board of Trustees has conducted itself. When James Montgomery, the only trustee to vote in favor of my appointment, finished an extraordinarily moving speech about his experiences of racism, board members responded with ill-advised and unfunny jokes, among other instances of boorishness. Ali Abu Nima, the journalist, caught system president Robert Easter in a flat-out lie. The board and the chancellor can't seem to get their story straight. Watching my own firing happen publicly on the internet was surreal, but not just for me. Anybody who tuned in could see how the corporatization of academe functions in real time. It was a pitiful performance whose racism wasn't quite submerged enough to call tacit. I think more than anything, the egregiousness of UIUC's decision illustrates that the furtive codes of campus repression have become less necessary. Academe has never been free. Universities don't like to be openly repressive, however. There are countless mechanisms in place to ensure conformity to the imperatives of the powerful and wealthy. These mechanisms regulate tone, content, action, and access. They constitute and co-opt reward systems and pervade both the notion and practice of merit. They will become unnecessary only when campuses become openly dictatorial. UIUC took a significant and unapologetic step in that direction. Other universities recently have made similar moves. Upper administrators, like most politicians, seize any pretext to consolidate power, whether it comes from pro-Israel lobbying, donor pressure, or conservative outrage. We are entering into an era in which repression can be formalized rather than informally maintained through common sense and consent. If boards and other upper administrators can simply decide without faculty consultation or the inconvenience of shared governance who is fit to teach and research, then the paradigms of higher education change in ways that contravene the very purpose of the university. I have no nostalgia about our academic past or of the utility of free speech in American society as a whole. Rights have never been comprehensive. But with this new paradigm, academic freedom won't even exist in theory. The business people who occupy governing boards will subsume intellectual pursuits to the fiscal interests that motivate any other corporate entity. Please bear in mind that members of the UIUC board admitted that in a meeting, a student representative read aloud some of my tweets. And within the space of 10 minutes, the board decided I was anti-Semitic and that therefore they couldn't have me on campus. This is remarkable. First of all, it indicates that I was indeed fired for the content of my political speech. More important, the board ignored a plethora of university bylaws regarding the hiring and firing of professors. It completely abrogated the work and vision of the American Indian Studies program. And it consciously damaged the university's ability to function normally based on a desire to appease donors. They accomplished all of this under the guise of multicultural valor, that is, protecting the campus from intolerance or discomfort. Please also bear in mind that board members have zero qualifications to evaluate my teaching or scholarship. They've never taught college. They know nothing about indigenous peoples, American Indians, the Israel-Palestine conflict, Arab Americans, Palestine, the Middle East, Pacific Islanders, military occupation, native nationalism, literary criticism, hermeneutics, critical theory, decolonization, scholarship, journal publishing, peer review, university presses, departmental service, advising, grading, curriculum, or how to compose a solitary footnote. How exactly this makes them qualified to make hiring decisions on behalf of the American Indian Studies program is a mystery, but they're quite certain they're capable arbiters of academic hiring. Questions arise about funding, but they all have an easy answer. It's always in some way about funding, isn't it? Always. If you crunch the raw numbers, though, it's clear that the university doesn't receive a windfall from those quick to complain about criticism of Israel. Steve Miller's largest gift appears to have been $500,000. Other donors who complained cited figures of a few hundred thousand. This is chump change to any huge research university. The value of the Zionist donors isn't merely about bank balances. It's about respectability and the unquantifiable value that accompanies it. Siding with Israel isn't necessarily about making money. It's about political ambition, conformity, establishment bona fides, state power. In other words, maintaining the status quo. It's about keeping power consolidated among the elite. It's about not setting the terrible precedent of allowing the colonized a say in their own futures. Political capital coheres and can never be precisely measured by supporting the preferred position of the elite. There's rarely risk in siding with the powerful, but never is there dignity in such a choice. Academics themselves are often complicit in restrictions on our freedom, so I don't think it's helpful to create a firm distinction between faculty and administration. The distinction should be made around faculty interests and administrative interests. One needn't be an administrator to supplement administrative interests. For this reason, I hope we complicate academic freedom even as we vigorously defend it. For example, contingent faculty have no functional academic freedom. They can be fired for unpopular speech without much recourse. It's not just finances that compel administrators to rely more heavily on untenured labor. It ensures a power balance that strongly favors the administration. The government has long relied on the private workplace to stifle speech rights, whereas one, hypothetically, cannot be imprisoned for speech. One can be fired by private employers for it, a mechanism of plutocratic control. It's a further entanglement of state and corporation, and a further entanglement of corporation and university. Academic freedom is not impervious or unchanging. It must constantly be reinvigorated and reassessed. Structures of inequality have always influenced how academic freedom is perceived and practiced. The rights of campus governance usually skew in the direction of convention. One way this happens is through unexamined commonplaces of language. Scholarship, for instance, is never supposed to be political. Well, what does political mean in this context? Basically, fighting injustice. Scholarship and scholars are supposed to be above such trifling pursuits. We demystify the things we study, but we don't participate in them. We explicate, but we do not manipulate. We're like the film crew of a nature show. We document and explain, but never intervene when one animal devours another. To be called political is immediately to become suspect among one's colleagues, to be marked as radical, another term with its own history of coerciveness. Serious scholars can never be radical. Let's look at the term most relevant to our current situation, civility, which is a reboot of the long-standing canard of collegiality. I believe that civility, although it performs the same coercive function as collegiality, is far more insidious and threatening. Before I explain why, though, a quick overview of how something that sounds so innocuous, even desirable, is in fact repressive. I've mentioned informal modes of repression. They're not informal in the sense of being random, but of being unauthorized or extra legal. All industrial democracies rely to some degree on informal repression, what Chomsky called manufacturing consent, and Gramsci, before him, termed hegemony. It's endemic to universities in particular because the conceits of shared governance and academic freedom must be delimited without open suppression, though open suppression happens plenty. Hence, collegiality is a measure of performance. It is a sprawling and subjective word, which is precisely its utility. I'm not going to attempt the definition because I consider that to be a pointless enterprise. Let's instead examine how its ambiguity facilitates conformity to majoritarian sensibilities. Valuable ideas disrupt, reorder, undermine, confront, subvert, unsettle, upset, menace, admonish, forebode. Critical thinking is fundamentally incompatible with conformity, which is collegiality's primary desire. Collegiality largely performs two functions. It can be used as a pretext to punish somebody whose work is stellar but who doesn't fit in with colleagues. Here, the severe problems of race, class, gender, sexuality, and culture should be obvious. And it can name unconventional scholarship as inferior because it doesn't recycle established ideas and methodologies. Collegiality is the etiquette of submission. It's impossible to be collegial when challenging the common sense of corporate dominion, no matter how politely you state the criticism. Now, collegiality has given way to civility, which creates a new set of challenges to academic freedom. The usefulness of the term as a silencing mechanism is apparent by how many upper administrators have embraced it. Its basic function is identical to that of collegiality, but it more explicitly evokes colonial violence. The very act of using uncivil to describe supporters of Palestine or any other site of decolonization is a terrible irony. The accusation locates the subject in the wretchedness of subhumanity, but implicates the speaker in centuries of colonization and genocide. Remember, I was hired in the American Indian Studies program. I still shake my head that the powers that be decided to rationalize their abrogation of academic freedom and faculty governance by invoking the terminology of New World colonization. It actually puts me in mind of George W. Bush calling his war on Iraq a crusade. And it's another reminder that there's no appreciable correlation between intelligence and authority. I shake my head, but I'm not surprised. Calling my sort of discourse uncivil isn't just a gaffe. It's a conscious statement of institutional values of neoliberalism, which requires dogged political supervision. Colonization is central to the conditions of neoliberalism on and off campus. The university's actions are a deliberate attack on the fields of American Indian and Indigenous studies and on ethnic studies in the humanities more broadly. As throughout American history, natives are an inconvenience to a grander democratic vision that cannot be realized without violence and that erases the elements of indigeneity that it cannot appropriate. The assumption underlying every justification of the administration's decision is that indigenous peoples cannot make autonomous decisions. They require the oversight of their more sage and responsible superiors. It's a perfect allegory of federal Indian policy, only it's not actually allegorical. A final word on civility. Even if we reduce the term to the crude, coercive context in which university administrators deploy it, something we should never do, those administrators still end up on the wrong side. Cheerleaders of civility have been utterly vicious throughout this affair, which always happens when Zionist groups target scholars and students. Palestinians and their allies face barrages of racist invective and verbal abuse to go along with the more civilized practices of microaggression and character assassination. I can't tell you how many people have gloated on my Twitter page about my having been fired, wishing all manner of harm upon me and my family. The advocates of civility are particularly nasty toward women of color. A white male told Jody Bird, a Choctaw, good riddance after she'd expressed concern about the administration's actions at a public forum. Christopher Kennedy boorishly dismissed Ojibwe Jeannie O'Brien in a much circulated email, suggesting that her only useful contribution would be silence. Somebody told a Palestinian student activist that he wanted to make lots of Muslim babies with her. I could go on, but I don't need to. People of color are fully familiar with these sorts of indignities, which do not emerge from the civilized world so much as they define it. On the other hand, the kindness and generosity of the uncivilized has been stunning. There are hundreds of Arab stereotypes, one of which, in my experience, is entirely true. We express love through food. I've been offered more to eat since my firing than Attila the Hun's army could consume in a year. Really, you know, just. In fact, folks of all backgrounds have offered unbelievable hospitality. People have offered money, homes, encouragement, acupuncture, you know, yoga via Skype, you know, you name it. It's been, in a word, love. Unfiltered, undiluted love. If this is incivility, then I ain't never gonna learn which fork is for the damn salad. There's one thing I remember most from these episodes of unmitigated brutality. The ice cream freezers. Nothing affected me more. Few things better exemplify the gaiety and innocence of childhood than rummaging through boxes of frozen confections. During Israel's bombing campaign, however, the ice cream freezers weren't stacked with popsicles and sorbet. Instead, they stored the bodies of dead children. The symbolism is endless. Ice cream and children's bodies. They usually intermingle in messy harmony. This time, though, the bodies had replaced the treats. The children had nothing to imbibe. Their corpses were on display for a much different sort of rummaging. They were in ice cream freezers because morgues had run out of space. A problem not only of warfare, but of overcrowded neighborhoods and geographical entrapment. Gaza's lack of electricity threatened rapid decomposition. The children rested atop one another in containers that likely provided some of their happiest moments when they were alive. There's nothing poetic about this juxtaposition. It's a terrible algorithm of combustion and confinement. Thus I tweeted, "The evidence in my case is clear. I'm no anti-Semite. I'm no terrorist. I'm no bully. I'm no savage. I'm a man who was fired because I condemned Israeli policy in language appropriate to a horrible occasion rather than in the meek platitudes of civility. I prefer moral clarity. After all, there's nothing civil about dead children in an ice cream freezer." Thank you.
That was Professor Stephen Salaita speaking at Northwestern University in Chicago on October 6th. Many thanks to Dale Lehman at WZRD for this recording. You can hear the entire speech on our SoundCloud page or at electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of writers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.